Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 6 of the Christmas New Scientist. Actually rather pleasant now here in Australia. Before it was 50 degrees or 49.4 degrees. Imagine that as a temperature. Okay. Cannibals, runaways, and supergiants. The cosmos is home to some of rogue stars, Stuart Clarke introduces the most outlandish. With hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy alone, I think it's supposed to be 2,000 billion, trillion, you'd expect a few oddballs, and you'd be right. Stars do follow a more or less set life path determined by their mass. But we're increasingly finding that details of those lives can diverge more than we ever imagined. In some cases, we're discovering stellar characteristics and habits so outlandish that they challenge our understanding of physics. Well, that's a pretty amazing thing. From cannibalistic stars to one that makes impossible elements and others that refuses to die, here's our introduction to some of the strangest stars in the universe. The one that got away. Our galaxy is leaking stars. And that is the only conclusion astronomers have been able to draw from the discovery of a few dozen stars travelling so fast that not even the gravity of the Milky Way can hold on to them. The record holder is SVHVS1, and clocks 1,700 kilometres per second, so fast that it's already broken out into the lonely reaches of intergalactic space. How has an enormous ball of gas accelerated at such speed? When Warren Brown at Harvard Smithsonian Center of Astrophysics identified the first hypervelocity star in 2005, it appeared to have come from the center of the galaxy. That pointed the finger at the supermassive black hole there. Brown's calculations show that if a pair of stars passes close enough, the black hole would snatch hold of one of them and shoot the other one off to space. Plot thickened last year when Monica Valuri at the University of Michigan led a team to investigate the LAMOST HV hypervelocity S1, the closest hypervelocity star to our sun. This one seems to have been ejected from a star cluster, which is odd because there's no black holes in clusters, or so we thought. But it would make sense if the cluster contained a suspect class of black holes, known as intermediate mass black holes, which so far has evaded definitive detection. Quote, it was very surprising, says Valuri. Quote, if we find more hypervelocity stars coming from star clusters, then we really need to investigate what's sitting in the centre of those clusters, she says. Perhaps the most intriguing thing about hypervelocity stars, however, is what they could reveal about dark matter. This is a hypothetical substance thought to hold galaxies together. By studying trajectories of the hypervelocity stars ejected from the galactic centre, astronomers hope to deduce the shape of dark matter cloud surrounding the Milky Way. That could give us a better idea of how dark matter interacts with itself, providing a vital new clue to its identity. It's very interesting about the arms of the
Milky Way being shockwaves.
I think it's interesting. Stars that make impossible elements. What it lacks in vowels, Biritz Biskly star, announced Bill Shibilsky, makes up for intrigue, and being the only star suspected to point to a radical extension of atomic physics. The mystery began in 1961 when astronomer attorney Shibilsky discovered something peculiar about the spectrum of the light of HD 101065. Spectra are nature's barcodes. Lovely. They feature dark lines superimposed on spectral colours, with positions and lines relative to colours telling us the star's chemical constituents. Ordinarily, the patterns are easy enough to decipher, but in this case, Zibitsky's star, the sheer number of lines makes it difficult to identify anything with certainty. 2008, a team of astronomers claimed to have spectral lines from Zibitsky's star were combining a group of heavy radioactive elements known as actinides, which is like uranium and all that type of stuff. This was startling because, although actinides can produce particle accelerators, the heavier members of the group weren't thought to appear in nature. Not only are they extremely difficult to produce, they decay quickly too. Einsteinism, for instance, has a half-life of just under 472 days. So such elements should long be gone for stars unless there was something replenishing them. As a result, some astronomers suspect the weird spectra of Zibitsky's star could be the first evidence of an island of stability, a fabled place beyond the existing periodic table, where superheavy elements long thought impossible in nature are stable enough to persist perhaps for tens of millions of years. Very high neutral flux. Makes me want to go back to the periodic table. The only place where these super heavy elements might be created within a supernova, the explosive death throes of certain stars. With that in mind, Vladimir Dzba of the University of New South Wales in Australia and his colleagues has suggested in 2017 that a shockwave from a nearby superwave nova could have triggered the formation of Zibitsky's star and loaded it with super heavy elements. The idea that those elements are decaying slowly, ensuring the star's atmosphere contains an abundance of decay products, such as einsteinium. It's a beautifully elegant solution, says Jason Wright of Pennsylvania State University, before pointing out the major caveat. The original identification of einsteinism is not secure. The reason for the suspicion is that at 660 degrees Kelvin, that's just not that much hotter than our star, the surface temperature of the star is hotter than most of other stars, and the atmosphere is likely to be hotter still. In these conditions, atoms have the outer electrons stripped away, turning them into ions. This changes the pattern of the spectral lines they emit. No lab has compiled a complete catalogue of spectral lines emitted by such ions, so we think einsteinism could well be a familiar element that has been misidentified. I would definitely say so. That would be definitely my answer. But 6,000, where 5,300 degrees Kelvin, it's not that much hotter than us. So there's 10,000 degrees Kelvin. I just have to go in my head. The one that refuses to die. A giant star blows itself to smithereens somewhere in the universe every single day. The supernova, the final act of a massive star's life, and they occur only when a star is turning over here. Oh gosh, I'm so tired. Running out of fuel for its nuclear reactions. By definition, it can only happen once in a given star. Imagine the shock when, in the Aki, then at Las Cumbres Observatory in California, found a star that seemed to explode over and over again. Supernova IPTF-14HL was discovered in 2014. Over the course of almost 2 years, Akvi and colleagues have watched Akvi flare up into no less than 5 times. Archive images from the Palomar Observatory, California, show the star could well have been exploding as early as 1954. But it wasn't until 1993 when another image of the host galaxy was taken. Perhaps the strangest thing was that the analysis of light coming from the star suggested it was completely normal, freshly exploded supernova, even hundreds of days into the explosion. Then, just when the researchers were getting used to the persistence, supernova disappeared. "It's the weirdest supernova I've ever seen," says Akvi, now at Tel Aviv University in Israel. There is currently no conclusive explanation. The best stab is, so far, as the star is so enormous that the interior is hot enough to form antimatter, triggering an explosion. Exco's team suggests that the process happened several times in the past, leading not to complete destruction of the star, but to a series of eruptions of the shells of the gas rejected into space. The most recent explosion then blasted out a shockwave of material, caught up and collided with the other ejected shells, one another, creating a fresh-looking flares to observe from Earth. Trouble is, the first shell release should carry away all the hydrogen gas. Yet, the case of IPFT-14HL, every time the light peak rose, the team saw chemical signature of this element. To figure out, Ackerby wants to find a similar supernova. Perhaps he should just wait, because in 2014, explosion may not be the last. Maybe it's still there, and it will surprise us again in 50 to 60 years, he says. The oldest star in the cosmos. Well, there you go. Could be anything. There is a star that seems to be older than the universe, unless the universe is older than we thought. The HD 140283 is around 200 light years from Earth. It's made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium. Oh, there you go. This suggests that it was one of the earliest stars to form, because stars reveal their approximate ages by the amount of metal. The astronomical term for any element heavier than helium they contain. Estimates of HD 104283 years age comes at around 14.46 billion years, whereas the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And there must have been at least one previous generation of stars to have produced metals in this star. The upshot is that either cosmology used to calculate the universe's age and still astrophysics used to calculate the star's age is wrong. Howard Bond, the Space Telescope Science Institute at Maryland, who did the estimations, thinks they could be out by 800 million years either way. That's big enough to bring the age star's age down to fit within the age of the universe, but it would have precious little time for the first generation of stars to live and die, all of which goes to show how little we know about the early days of the cosmos. The one so big it would engulf Jupiter. Well, that doesn't really mean much. When it comes to deciding the biggest star in the galaxy, there's some gigantuans. I don't know what that means. Contenders. In 2013, astronomers measured three red supergiants. They found that they were 1,000 times larger than the Sun, but the winner is UI Scuti. This one is a hypergiant because estimates suggest it's 1,708 times larger than the Sun. If it were to replace our star, it would reach almost the way to Saturn's orbit. Oh, okay. Yeah. And talk about bright. Yuri is 300,000 times more luminous than the Sun. Its status as the biggest in the of the big is disputed, however, by another group of astronomers. We think the star much closer to Earth than it's generally thought of. So UT must be smaller, perhaps 825 times the size of the Sun. Even at the largest estimate, UT could still be dwarfed by the star WOHG64, which resides in a nearby galaxy. The Large Magellanic Cloud. Estimates place it somewhere between 1,540 to a whopping 2,575 times the size of the Sun, although its greater distance from us makes it even harder to measure accurately. Well, there you go, the luminosity. The star that eats its twin. Algae is one of the only variable stars in the night sky noticeable to the naked eye. Every 2.8767 days, it fades for 10 hours and then returns to normal. A wink that led the ancient Greeks to draw the constellation of Perseus around it and label the eye of the snake ahead Medusa. That's interesting. We now understand Ogle is a pair of systems in which two stars regularly eclipse one another, but the 2.867-day orbit still presents a puzzle. To travel that fast around each other, the stars would be so close that one pulls gas from another. This would slowly push the pair away from another, lengthening the orbit, but astronomers haven't seen a sign of this. Turns out the ancients may provide the answer. Sebastian Perkel at University of Helsinki, Finland, believes that the ancient Egyptians based some of their calendar's unlucky days on Ogle's eclipses. The periodicity was found was about 20 minutes shorter than Ogle's system today, and that amount could easily be explained by the stars pulling gas from one another. That is interesting. I find that very, very interesting. Heaven sent. Frankincense resin used to be a gift of the king, but then everyone wanted a piece back then. Oh. As you close your eyes and inhale frankincense oil, you'd see yourself waking in a pine eucalyptus forest, your steps taking you to a sunbathed clearing. Here, a steamy spring welcomes you with its warm, surprising citrus-scented water. While you thought you couldn't be more relaxed, a misty incense smoke spread around you, balancing the settling the mind. These honeyed pros from the website of cosmetic company Lush underlines what is clear 2 million ago. There's something magical about frankincense. The biblical telling in the birth of Jesus make it deemed worthy of a king. As wise men, they knew about these things. Frankincense was once one of the most valuable commodities in the ancient world. Today, we're probably most likely to associate it with the emanations from incense burning tunables that swing around many Christmas Christian churches. Just recently, the wilder world has renewed interest in the scent. That is creating a problem with rocketing demand for frankincense oil, endangering its supply. It is a classic tale of conflict economy and ecology. But the hope is that the season of goodwill will promise its redemption. This one might have a happy ending. The backdrop for the struggle is formed by landscapes that could hardly be more different than those conjured up by the Lush website. The hard scrabble semi-desert of the Middle East, the Horn of Africa, is part of and parts of India. Scrubland forests are home to the boswellia, a genus of shrub-like trees whose bark produces the aromatic cream-coloured resinous sap. And when careful incisions are made in the bark, the sap oozes out and dries up to harden in the sun. Burned or smouldered over hot coals, this resin releases an intense sweet aroma. We have evidence of frankincense being traded in the Arabian Peninsula 6,000 years ago. The Torah and the Talmud make extensive mention of it, often being sprinkled into offerings into the deity to give them a sweet smell when they are burned. They are also highly valued and embalming material, both as an offering unto departed and as a means to cover the odour of the dead body. By the time the ancient Greece reached its zenith, a well-organized frankincense trail was brought precious substance from the east. Besides its continued presence in places of worship today, frankincense is also used in traditional medicine as a remedy for conditions including ulcers, hypertension, fever, indigestion, coughs, as well as post-birth recovery. It's burned so that its smoke can drive away mosquitoes in malaria-affected regions. In part of Otman's, it's found in everything from deodorant, frankincense deodorant. Oh my god, that would sound a bit weird. Okay, just turning the page here, mate. Sorry, you scientist people. And toothpaste to food and drink flavouring. Boswellia habitats have been under pressure for decades. Rising populations have increased demand for firewood and land for farming. Expanding capital and goat herds gobble up the tree seedlings before they have a chance to grow. These factors are contributing to what forest ecologist Frans Borrehu at Wendigo University and research in the Netherlands referred to as a cryptic collapse of the tree population in Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, South Sudan, the countries from which most of the frankincense comes. Borrehu's interest in frankincense for us began 20 years ago with an invitation from one of his doctoral students, Wildasi Ogbazahayi, to visit the forest at Eritrea. In a research published early this year, Bongers, Ozari and colleagues looked at 23 populations of Boswellia paraprofera, the species that accounts for 2/3 of global frankincense production across Ethiopia and Sudan. They found that more than half the populations had no young trees. Tree ring analysis suggested there had been several decades since the seedlings had grown to become saplings or mature trees. When you look at the active forest, there are trees being cut and used for frankincense. There are no new trees. In some of the sites, the youngest trees are more than 50 years old, with boniferous trees living to 70 years on average. That indicates an impending catastrophe. Models suggest frankincense production will drop dramatically and rapidly to half in the level in the following 20 years. Improved fencing and fire breaks, coupled with a concerted program to plant new seedlings and saplings, would still turn things around, he says. But that isn't the whole story of Brazil's decline. In the past few years, trappers whose livelihood depended on frankincense have been abandoning the age-old practice to extract more resin than is good for the tree and the surrounding ecosystem. The booming market. Frankincense resin has antibacterial and antifungal properties and has a sealant barrier. It plays a vital part in the tree's survival. Taking too much of the resin during tapping trees is vulnerable to pathogens and infestations by insects such as the longhorn beetle. It also drains the trees of nutrients needed for reproduction. This could lead to the tree producing smaller, poor quality seeds and undeveloped saplings that are easily picked off by fires and grass cattle, says Bongers. Again, simple measures to help reducing the intensity of tapping and the numbers and size of tapping spots on existing trees, as well as implementing tap-free rest years and using less damaging techniques and devices, can improve the tree's viability and prolong the lifespan. Admittedly, that's easier said than done, says Janice Cadicalo of St. Michael's College of Vermont. She leads conservation projects in the Horn of Africa, particularly Somaliland, the Breakaway Republic in the northern part of Somalia. In a place like Somaliland, they don't have the resources to have environmental policies in place, she says. It's hampered by the fact that we're talking about difficult physical geographies and areas where there are security issues. Frankincense is one of the few internationally tradable commodities these areas have, so it's small wonder people want to exploit the booming market. Frankincense has become the king of a multi-billion dollar essential oil industry, says De Carlo. She first visited Somalia in 2011 and then again in 2016 and couldn't believe the difference. There were new, more powerful bars with suppliers harvesting frankincense resin more intensively in different species than before. There are people in this business who are not thinking long term, they're thinking about their profits. Her team is aiming to counter this by training tappers in Somalia in sustainable techniques. Importing best practices from neighbouring Ethiopia might also help. And the government guidelines recommending reducing the number of tapping spots, preventing deep cuts, and giving the tree 1 or 2 years of rest after 3 or 5 years of tapping. Abby Ashley of the Ethiopian Environment and Forest Research Institute of Addis Ababa says guidelines have given local producers more awareness of sustainable tapping practices. Rest periods have been implemented in some areas, and the Institute also encouraging tappers to form cooperatives, granting them rights of ownership and shared profits with government-controlled companies, which are entering the market previously dominated by private companies. These cooperatives are often better compared to private companies at managing resources at local level because they hire local people who care about their land, says Eshlet. The government input is still important in bringing international expertise into sustainable production, he says. Quote, we don't have the resources to provide this, but with the right support, both financial and technical, we can improve the situation. It is a pitch in Somalia, says Dekala. Quote, We need scientific expertise from every country where the trees grow to make a coordinated effort. But it can be done. It just needs the right amount of oversight and rights from incentivizing, says Brongers. That means paying Francis tappers with good quality resin for healthy trees rather than for a given amount. DiCarlo stresses the need to raise consumer awareness of where Francis comes from and the true cost, as well as to encourage companies to be open about their supply chains. I'm not going to let these trees go without a fight, but the science is not enough, she says. The pressure that needs to be put on these companies to be transparent, show where Francis comes from, and to do due diligence. Lush, for one, says, is doing just that. Quote, we're aware of the concerns regarding the future of frankincense and the importance of sustainability for harvesting of resins, says Gadi Ladoff, the firm's global buying coordinator. She says the company doesn't use third parties, instead buying its frankincense from one trusted supplier that sources the resin from SAG region, Somalia. The supplier commits a portion of its revenues towards improving access to water, food security and access to healthcare in harvesting communities. This is Lush, and it contributes towards conservation efforts, including funding the nursery to propagate another species, Boswellia caryllii. Such efforts and more will be needed to allow Francis to turn the corner. In November 2018, Bogans organised the first international conference on Francis sustainability in Muscat, Oman. The location was a deliberate choice. In the pre-1990s, Oman drastically reduced exports of frankincense to help protect the indigenous Boswellia caryllii and established large-scale frankincense plantations. It is a far cry from millennia-old traditions of small-scale tapping, but to save our iconic species, perhaps it's the best option we have. It's very interesting. I didn't know all that about frankincense. It's really... she is, to be frank, incensed. Uh-huh. That was sort of a new scientist joke. 27 minutes in, see how we go. Rudolph's real superpowers. The magical ability of reindeer is the stuff of Christmas folklore, but in reality, it's even more impressive. As any young child knows, reindeer have a special superpower. They can fly. Or at least Rudolph and his 8 sleigh-towing pals. Reindeer first took to the sky in 1823 when Clement Clark Moore published "'Twas the Night Before Christmas." He is said to have got his inspiration from the Salmi people in Northern Europe, whose shamans conjured up while flying reindeer while in magic mushroom-induced trances. Unfortunately, it's all bunkum, even the bit about Salmi, but who needs fiction? Reindeer in the real world of superpowers. Animals have evolved a whole range of amazing innovations to let them not just survive and thrive in the frigid Arctic. Their eyes change colour like living sunglasses from gold in summer to blue in winter. They see the world in glorious ultraviolet. They can switch their body clocks on and off, produce lots of vitamin D and even in limited amounts of sunlight, and grow antlers up to a metre long in just a few months. What's more, we might be able to borrow some of those abilities. Discovering more about Rudolph would lead to new ways of tackling jet lag, insomnia and cancer, and even allow the growth of new limbs, thanks to recent work revealing the genetic underpinnings of the reindeer unusual traits. Their superpowers could be one day ours. Nearly 5 million reindeer roam the frozen north of Alaska, Siberia and Greenland. The biggest group, containing about 500,000 animals, the tummy herd of Siberia tundra, also known as caribou in North America. These lichen-eating ruminants, cows, are the only deer species to have been tamed by humans. That's interesting. And about half are domesticated. On the Norwegian island of Svalbard, males of the small subspecies weigh no more than 60 kilograms. In the forests of Finland, a stag can tip 250 kilograms. Where they live, reindeer face challenges that would kill most other animals, including severe cold, limited food, winter, and extremely prolonged periods of daylight and darkness. In June this year, some of the genes that allow them to overcome these problems were revealed in the first results of the Ruminant Genome Project. It compared reindeer DNA with that of other animals that chewed cud and identified mutations galore. Quote, "We're surprised to find so many unique gene variants related to the reindeer's adaptation in the Arctic environment," says Zeping Li at the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences. Quote, "Many of the same genes are involved in the same processes in reindeer as they are in humans," says Ramos Heller at the University of Copenhagen, Denmark, who is also part of the project. The biological clock humans, the most other animals, have a daily rhythms of activity and inactivity linked to light and dark, driven by the circadian clock. Reindeers do too, but they override this. In the 24-hour daylight of the Antarctic summer, they forage almost around the clock and can put so they can put on as much weight as possible. In the dark depths of the winter, their metabolic levels plummet and they have only short bouts of activities and don't adhere to a 24-hour pattern. They share this ability to break rhythm of a circadian clock with other polar animals, including the emperor penguin and a type of grouse called the rock patagon. Quote, "If you are an Arctic animal and you face and you're faced with the weirdness of light conditions, Cecilia, this challenge for animals doesn't have the genetic background to cope with it. It would mess everything up from hormones to physiology. The Ruminant Genome studies reveal what's going on in reindeer. They have a unique version of the genes that drive circadian rhythm. In particular, this means that one key protein called PERV2 is mutated so that another protein, crucial for the regular cycle, can't bind. A vital part of the biological clock malfunction, says Lilia. Cure for jet lag. The discovery of the gene variants in the reindeer could perhaps be explored to help humans overcome jet lag, which results in having to readjust to the light-dark cycle in a different time zone. The disruptions to the circadian rhythm are also thought to play a role in modern disorders such as depression. Biological mechanisms underpinning how reindeer override their circadian rhythms could provide insight into sleepiness, too. The specific gene variants involved in insomnia, we can compare these with the genes of reindeer to further understand how people's circadian rhythms is affected. Another impressive ability is the way both male and female reindeer grow new antlers every year. Inside the placenta, deer antlers are only mammalian organs that can be completely regenerated outside. Oh, really? Reindeer's headgear can add up to 10 kilograms of bone and blood vessels and grow at 2.5 centimeters a day. How could they achieve this? Research published this year provides an answer. The genes that get turned on in cells destined to become antlers are also turned on in cancer cells. This is Junsi Peter Yang, tissue engineer at Stanford, California. Tissue regeneration and cancer growth are two sides of the same coin. Yet, deers and reindeer are five times less likely to get cancer than other animals because they have evolved a highly efficient tumor suppression mechanism that controls the otherwise dangerous cancerous pathways. This extraordinary ability makes them a great interest to researchers looking for new ways to prevent and treat cancers in humans. Growing antlers requires a lot of calcium, and that presents another challenge. To absorb calcium from food, the gut, animals need vitamin D, which is made through the action of sunlight on the skin. It's particularly important for reindeer to maximize the calcium uptake of vitamin D production, but this is challenging in an environment where there is essentially no sunlight for half the year. The reindeer solution, the Ruminant Genome Project found, is a super system for producing vitamin D that is far more efficient than ours. Understanding how reindeer antlers grow might help us regenerate tissues in humans. We can borrow the same mechanisms than bone diseases, osteoporosis and bone cancer, says Yang. There's so much potential. Some of it has already been realised. The way antlers are attached to the skull has inspired the design of a new kind of bone-anchored prosthesis in humans with people with missing limbs. Flying and red noses are very impressive, but it turns out the real reindeer powers are just as exciting, and more importantly, they're not just for Christmas. Okay. So I'm just going to really go over and remember there's that reindeer article, and what was the article before it? That was the Frankincense article. So that's really doing it here. Sorry if you've had this before. Toast tonic. So I think this is the quinine story. Gin's other half has a sparkling history, Stephanie Payne. The bark of Chinooquis native forest yields quinine for tonic water. Liver feeling torpid, nerves debilitated, stomach weak, as did the Victorians did, and pour yourself and top up with the soft stuff, a tongue-tingling glass of tonic water, best known today as half of the ultimate English cocktail. It started out as a drink to revitalize the body and revise the spirit. Now, its sparkling story is revealed thanks to two tonic-tipping botanists. On blistering August afternoon, which is obviously in the Northern Hemisphere, very definitely a gin and tonic sort of day, I headed to the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew to meet King Walker and Mark Nesbitt. I soon found myself blissfully cool interior of a temperature-controlled storehouse. There, among Kew Gardens' vast assemblage of botanical treasures, is the world's largest collection of bark from corona trees, the source of the tonic's most vital ingredient, quinine. Rack after rack, floor-to-ceiling shelves, holds thousands of bundles of bark, along with bottles, packets and jars of chinole seed, powder and extracts. Walker and Nesbitt have scoured this collection of Kew's archives to trace the evolution of tonic water in the new book, Just the Tonic, The Natural History of Tonic Water. Both the tastes and the fears, it turns out, are rooted in medicine. The tale of discovery, invention, imperial ambition, bar of piracy with generous garnish of myth. I think the well, it'd be interesting. I do remember, it was stolen, oh, let's read it. Chinchilla tree lives in native South America. There are 25 species, the 25th discovered in 2013, all restricted to cloud forests strung along the eastern slopes of the Andes and from Colombia to Chile. The tree's bark contains dozens of bitter alkaloids, including quinine. In nature, quinine's job is to deter hungry herbivores. In tonic, it provides a characteristic bitter flower and a refreshing astringency. But for almost 300 years, it was the only cure for malaria known as to the West. It's, as befits a miracle cure, much of the story is unreliable. How, for instance, were the bark curative properties discovered? The oldest surviving written record is used to treat malaria dates from 1633, Spanish colonization of South America. Now, who was it? Someone stole it? Was it Drake? I can't remember. Okay. One tale claims that it was discovered when a feverish Jesuit priest rediscovered it after drinking water from a lake containing fallen chinola trees. But the fact that local people knew chinola was the fever tree suggests that they had been using it long before the Spanish arrived, although not for malaria, which is unknown in the Andes. Travelling in Ecuador in the 18th century, French explorer Charles Malher de la Condamine wrote to the indigenous people there had gotten onto its power after watching mountain lions chewing the bark. However, it was discovered before the 1630s were out, news the cure supplies bark reached Spain. Legend has it that in 1838, Countess Chichon, wife of the Viceroy of Peru, was dying of fever, but was saved by the bark. Gratefully, she sailed back to Spain and spread the word. More than a century later, botanist Carl Linnaeus reinforced the story by naming the tree Chinchona, his science being rather better than his spelling. The tale being thoroughly debunked yet. see for now. There is more likely that the Jesuit priests returning from South America introduced the cure to Europe. From the start, it was known as Jesuit Bar, a name that saw Protestant English and the Dutch poo-poo it as a poopish fraud, as it so obviously worked, they didn't hold out for long. The supplies of the bark spread rapidly across Europe, where malaria remained a scourge in low-lying marshy regions as well as the 20th century. In 1677, Jesuit bark was listed in the London Pharmacopoeia as an excellent thing against all sorts of agers. For two centuries, Europe imported China's bark from South America. The trade was highly destructive. Like cinnamon, for example, local people would fell whole trees to harvest the bark, says Andre Antelli, Kew's director of science, an expert in chinchilla. In 1802, while travelling to Chile, German explorer Alexander von Humboldt noted how older, thicker trees had become scarce. He was alarmed by the unsustainable harvest and the impact of Europe's supplies, says Antelli. He wasn't alone. By the mid-19th century, demand of chinchilla bark had soared following the isolation of quinine and trials showing that it was effective prophylactic against malaria as well as a cure. Europeans wanted to control the quantity and quality by growing chinchilla of their own plantations in the tropics parts of their empires, says Nesbitt. But the Andean people were aware if foreigners acquired the tree, their life would be at risk, so getting hold of the seeds and young plants required a subterfuge. There is where the prospect of arrest or worse in Peru, rumour had it, that anyone caught stealing the trees would have their feet chopped off. But the political instability of the region made good for biopiracy. Protestant explorers did acquire the seedlings and seeds, but all too often, the young plants died and the seeds grew into trees that produced little quinine. The amount of quinine varies from species to species. The concentration ranged from 0.2% to 13%. Collecting seeds was gamble, says Walker. It could be 10 years before you knew if your trees were useful. Half the bark sample at Kew come from a collection of John Elliot Howard, an English pharmacist or quinologist who spent his career trying to solve the riddle of which imported trees were best and where exactly they came from. Howard had to reverse botany, trying to connect the part of the bark to the species of the tree and geographical origin so collectors could target the best trees for cultivation, says Walter. Many samples come with details of Howard's chemical analysis attached. They're remarkably accurate, as recent analysis shows. In 1880s, the British and Dutch plantations in India and Indonesia were destroyed South American trade. It never recovered. Quinine remained the most important antimalarial drugs to the 1940s until synthetic alternatives became available. Chinchilla might have saved more human lives than any other plant, says Santelli. Quinine extracted from bark still has a role in medicine, treating lead cramps and rheumatoid arthritis. It's used to treat malaria. It is resistant to synthetic drugs. So much for tonic water's health-giving flavour. How about the other half, the refreshing bubbly water? That too owes its origin to people's never-ending quest for well-being. Spas and mineral waters have an age-old reputation for health-boosting drinks. Their popularity skyrocketed in the 18th century when fizzy water was made its debut courtesy of the chemical whiz Joseph Priestley. In 1767, he invented a way to dissolve fixed air carbon dioxide into water to add sparkle. Or the more delicious sounding bubbling scintillation. Soon aerated waters were being sold for disorders as varied as gout and indigestion, and a general panacea. So, frankincense tonic. Adding bicarbonate of soda helped dissolve more CO2, creating the first soda water, which was soon available to all good pharmacies. All that remained to create tonic water was the addition of quinine. With its reputation as wonder drug, it had already found its way to all sorts of quack remedies and tonics, drinks touted as treatments for everything, for dysentery to smallpox, toothaches to baldness, and all-purpose restoratives. In the Victorian times, tonic wines were a theme. Wine helped mask the bitter taste. They were suspiciously popular. Doctors feared that they were a front for tippling and could lead to alcoholism. What better than to pick me up without alcohol? In 1835, Hughes & Co. purveyors celebrate quinine pills, corn plasters, and French embrocation advertising new product, quinine soda water. It sank without a trace. But in 1858, Erasmus Bond had more success, possibly thanks to a better choice of name. Pitt's patients patent aerated air water. There was the word tonic, with the beguiling promise of better health. Other brands followed, and although initially recommended as an aid for digestion, tonic water rapidly became known as a wholesome, refreshing drink. People, especially in the hot climates, quaff a quantity. Yes, hon? Okay, I'll do that now, hon.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.